Thank you very much, Lou. I don't remember how fast or slow we were going. My slides here, when I was asked to give a talk here, I wasn't really sure the focus of the conference you're having in terms of the days you've gone through and how much of the technology you've been exposed to as well as experimented with yourself. My business in Bell Labs is to explore new media technologies as well as see how they get deployed in the network. But let me tell you what my personal thrust is and how it relates to the larger sort of goal you have. You've already heard about a lot of the new technologies like streaming. I believe there was forums on data casting, how internet is affecting it, how media and videos, digital videos coming around. I started out in multimedia communications many, many years back for Bell Labs. I'm by training a computer engineer, and my biggest interest when I was in school was to design the world's largest computer. And you know, anybody, I'm sure all of you, when you grow up, you want to be the world's largest, whatever you're doing, sort of thing. So in those days, people are building computers, and so something called parallel computers had just come out. So I don't know how many of you heard of like ILIAC 4 and the connection machine and all that. Everybody wants to have a million node machine, a billion node machine. All that. So I believe we are doing that today. It's just that our world's largest computer happens to be all of us. And that realization came to me in 86, which was that ultimately what we are building is really a networked world in which all of us are going to be input part of it. We are the brains actually behind it. And what the network's going to allow us to work and think together. And that's a very undaunting task, because think of a billion people communicating and talking. But today, if you look back, that's what's happening. The web and the internet is already allowing you to do that, and the phone network. So at that time, we were really debating on the question, so what does a person want when he wants to communicate with somebody? And you know, who really cares about multimedia? Because I was, at that time, had done computer design for about 15 years, and computers don't care about multimedia. It's all ones and zeros. And down there, when you get there, every wire, every bit, whether it's video, digital, whatever it is, it all looks like a one and zero. It's all binary. It's all bits that are flying at different speeds. The interpretation of all this data and media that comes across is with the users. You and I care whether it's video, it's audio, things like that. So the way I relate the multimedia experience is that I grew up in India when there were no, at a time when there was no television and a time when there were none of these great roller coasters and things like that. So when I first came to this country, I was going to get my PhD at Rice University. I went to great, you know, one of these great adventures, sort of like Disney Park or something, took part in the roller coaster. And you know, I'd seen movies of it, it's a very scary experience and all that. But when I actually took part in it, it was the best experience I'd had. And it was the best multimedia experience I had. And the reason for that is that there is no way you can explain to somebody, even by watching a movie, even with an IMAX and all the elements that go simultaneously to give you the experience. The importance of multimedia is not just the video part of the audio. The wind blowing by, the 3G effect, your stomach being overturned, the way you're scared, your cap being flown off and never being able to find it again. All those things add to the experience. And somehow you're talking to somebody, never you can relate it. You can be a great writer and great storyteller in terms of video and all. But that multimedia experience is what you really want. And that's why when you go do it yourself, it's all those elements all at the same time leave a different impression in your brain about what the experience is. So by the same token, when we mean by multimedia, we really want it to be an immersive experience. We want you to feel as if you were there, you were at the event, you were actually experiencing the bullets flying by or scared as hell or whatever the deal is in terms of the event that you're covering. And that's sort of the style that we're trying to go after. So one goal is, when I say kind of the speed of light, you know, video already moves at the speed of light, so that's redundant actually. But what we really mean is that we want to really bring your presence there, essentially. That you bring not just video, but any other effect, sound, whatever else is there, as if you're at the event that's happening, that you're participating. The second biggest problem we have is when we're talking about networking in general, and I was saying we want to bring an immersive experience. So I want to ask the question, you know, if you are trying to design from scratch today as an engineer or as a person who was given all the resources, how would you network everybody today? If you were given a choice to ideally network somebody, would you set up a TV network today? Would you set up a radio network? Now, if you look at the way we have evolved in sort of history, we are connected by actually multiple networks. Today, you have a telephony network for doing voice interaction, completely worldwide. I can reach anyone through a cell phone, through wireless, but that does not, it's a very separate network, separate organization, separate protocol, separate piece of wire from the broadcast network. We have a separate network for video broadcast. We have a separate network for data. It's sort of overlaid on telephone wires, but to most effective purposes, it's essentially a separate network. We have a separate network for radio. Now, when we are talking to each other, you know, I'm just going to take the instance of how we are networked with each other. Okay? If you think of what we are doing, right now, if all of you closed your eyes, our video network will disappear. Okay? It's like I'm on radio doing a radio broadcast, right? My audio is going to go to all of you. But you notice, just by merely closing your eyes, we managed to select or deselect a network. The network's already there. The video network is there. The audio network is there. The smell network is there. It's kind of slow, so I can't smell of you guys, thank God. But, you know, or you can't smell me. No. But it is there. You know, we are actually immersed in all these networks at all times. What we do is, depending on the kind of conversation we have, we take our particular cut at the network. Okay? So if I'm standing in a hallway conversation with you, it is the same network. It is the same air that's carrying sound. It is the same light system that's carrying video for us. It's just pervasive everywhere. It gives us enough richness that we can construct a multicast broadcast network like this one, where I'm yelling and all of you can listen, or a private conversation, two-party, or a three-party conversation, or just a voice conversation. We can close our eyes. We can be in the dark and carrying a conversation and not have light, or just carry sign language, have a video conversation, and not have a sound conversation. But the thing is, those are more or less our choices. The network is very rich in the way we can configure it. We don't even think about it. We don't configure a network. We just say, the way I want to use it is, let's get 100 people together. I'll stand up on a podium. They can all see me, and I'll use it. Okay? We have a well-established sort of paradigm that each of us does not have to be trained to be a network designer. We are merely users, and the network automatically accommodates ourselves. Now, today's network is not like that. Today, the network is designed by network designers like me, who want to make money by selling you best phone lines, best fibers, all that, or sell you best network. Then there are content producers like you are, and then there are the consumers. The consumer today does not say, I want to participate in a class with these 60 students. Can I configure a network on the fly, have a lecture, and have a session with them? And I want to send audio, video, and so can you do that? And what I'm going to show you is that that's where we're evolving to. The world is going to move to that. And that's the important thing here in terms of how we're going to end up not just be networked to each other, but how we're actually going to assume what the network can do for us in terms of the capability. So the things we want out of tomorrow's network is that we always want it to be always on. Just like air and light is always on, the sun comes up and you have a video network. It's all pervasive everywhere. Nobody questions it there. Nobody has to pay a dime for it. And it's all sort of given to you. Now, in our world, of course, we'll charge a dime. It'll just be so pervasive, it'll be like the tax system. You'll assume it's always there and always paid for. We want everyone to use multimedia traffic. We don't want you to just think of a radio broadcast or a video broadcast. We just want you to think, what story do you want to tell? What sort of experience do you want to have with users? And then the media should come into play. First thing to think is, you as a program creator, what is the program going to reach out to? How many people? What sort of interaction? Do you want it to be interaction? Do you want it to be just a lecture? Do you just want it to be one-way channel? All those parameters, if you specify, the network should be able to configure to do that. We want there to be enough bandwidth for different. So I'm going to discuss what is really, how much bandwidth is good enough for a user? And how much bandwidth do you really consume? You know, they also said that our brain can only process information so fast. It doesn't matter how much information you give it. Okay, it is not really, if you ideally look at the bits, by the way, we only move at about 5 to 10 bits a second is what we sort of really absorb the essence. And the essence of that you already know. You know, a word can, you know, people say a picture can be 1,000 words, but in a conversation, I can send you bits and bits and bits, gigabits. It may mean nothing to you. I can say one word like money, and everybody will understand what it means. So the number of bits in that information that passed was very little. And it means a lot to you because it already has a well-built structure of what it means in your life, association, all that. And I can talk 3 hours about some technology here, about coding technology, and it may mean nothing to you. You can walk out of here, and all those bits will be able to go to waste. So it's not just the amount of bits that are flying around. It's also what that bit does to you. I can do one bit transformation to you, and it can mean a lot more to you than having a million bits that just go around freely all over the place. And you can see that on the net already. We're being flooded with information, and it doesn't, 90% of it is junk in some sense. You have a bigger task now to reject the junk than to actually find the useful stuff. What I really want to address is the specific bandwidth for different users, is how our need for bandwidth and our need for content is different per user. So what's definitely going to happen in the world is much more targeted specialization. Just like you're already doing in the content distribution business, the way cable came around, the way pay-per-view and all that, is you're already targeting the programs to more specific markets and even ads to more specific people. We want it ultimately to be very personalized. So the programs I watch and how I watch them and the programs you deliver would be very targeted to each user. And can we do that with these networks? So in the end, the key of this is going to be we're going to end up creating basically virtual networks. And it is going to provide a way for content provider to achieve user grouping. Let me give you an example of that. Today in the internet, the way internet really took off in terms of interactive space is by something called chat rooms or by creating sort of groupings. I don't know, back in the 10, 15 years, if you ever use the internet, the very popular thing those days was news groups. I don't know how many of you actually sat in ARPA and mail or something. Us computer hackers used to always use those before it was called the internet. But the main impact of internet has been what we call as multi-point groupings. It allows, it's a structure that allows you to create groups of people. Today, the most popular things, you know, the biggest company in terms of internet communications, AOL, and their number one application is instant chat or chat rooms. I don't know how, you know, I guess we're all too old to participate in chat rooms. But I know anybody under 18 knows that's their number one application. If you'll ask them what they use their on time on the internet for, that's the number one application today. And what it's allowing you to do is allowing you to find in the billions of people, you know, the worldwide population, the three guys that you want to chat with. Okay? It's allowing you to find a multi-point group around topics of specialization. So there are people talk, there are, by the way, chat rooms of guys who go around and take spray cans and spray on subway cars, write graffiti on that. Did you know there's a group like that? Now, who would have thought they would use technology like that to discuss how they spray cans in Germany versus US? But this is technology. I mean, it's really amazing. But that shows you the power that if you allow the network, we have interest groups here that we can reach out worldwide and be able to talk to them. Now, how would you ever found these people? You know, the internet has allowed you. You go out in there, you search for these things, you search for topics, and all of a sudden you find there's an interest group in PBS technology. My goodness. You know, you can find people who have public television networks all over the world and get together with that. That is what I think is very, very powerful, this whole concept of being able to specialize into user groups and user interests. Now, the other thing is that this is actually not a very permanent thing. You not only want to be able to do that, which is what sort of your markets are like. You sort of specialize in a market that addresses students or children or a Sesame Street program that's targeted towards kids of certain age. We always do that. But the question is how flexibly and how often you can create that. If you look at your own example, okay, we in our own lives don't just communicate in a single group. Okay, we belong to many, many groups. I belong to a family. You know, I have my wife and children. I belong to a corporation. I belong to a tennis club. I belong to a church. I belong to a religious group. If you look at the number of associations you have, I belong to this group in terms of a visitor. If you think of the number of associations you have, they're enormous. They're all multi-point groups of some kind or the other, and you form them very conveniently, and you participate in them very conveniently, depending on the topic of the interest you have. We want that sort of flexibility to be there, to be able to, on demand, be able to create such groupings and be able to exchange information based on that. So how would you go about doing that? Let's first look at the technology side of it. So, you know, one is always saying the technology needs to keep growing and growing. What is the end? Do users really want terabits of them? Do they want to keep sucking more and more bandwidth? Doesn't matter what we provide, would we ever be able to scale to that? So we decided to look at today, considering the rich media we already have, what is it that you need? Or what would be adequate, for example? So we looked at the bandwidth from just content that comes to your house today. You may want multiple video streams. That's what I call 1 to 5 MPEG-2 streams. Now, we're looking at content from point of view of a family. Today, I know at my house, I have like 3 TVs, 4 PCs. Maybe I'm unusual. I'm too wired, I think, and I have 5 telephone lines coming into my house. So I may not be a good example. But I know that the trend is, in general, that people have multiple, you know, kids are watching a separate program, parents are watching a separate program. Even among kids, I have 3, and I've gone through these wars of one person wants to watch one program, another one wants to watch something else. You generally would be able to offer multiple video streams to a house, multiple audio streams to a house. Everybody carries around their own Discman these days or listen to their own MP3 player or radio station. Multiple voice lines in a house, that's becoming quite standard. If you at least have an office line or a data line as well as your normal line, people have something called a teen line. You know, anybody who's had teenagers know that you cannot interrupt their conversations. You know, you can't get a call through in the house if you don't have a separate line to them. If you add, and we are also taking that the quality of programming will improve. So even if you send an HDTV program about 20 megabits to the house, it turns out that a normal, even projecting for the next 5-6 years, a need would be less than total 100 megabits a second. Now, it turns out 100 megabits is really not that much. I know it may sound a lot to somebody who's got a 14.4 modem at the house today, but if you go to any work environment or you go to a LAN environment, in the old days we used to say 3 megabit Ethernet was way too much bandwidth. And today all office environments have 100 megabit, LAN environment, we are moving past 10 megabit standard, it's as cheap to install a 100 megabit network. And in fact, in some cities, already buildings are being wired with 100 megabits fiber everywhere. And if you put fiber in, you sort of by default, that's the low end of it. You start out with a megabit and higher, and 100 megabits is not a very big deal. The nice thing about the fiber is the high end on the fiber is terabits. That's 10 to the 12 bits or more. So you're looking at a new infrastructure that's actually going to move bandwidth to a new scale. It's like having copper wire. Copper wire, when we were in the old days, I don't know how many people used those acoustic couplers with 110 baud. And we said, I remember being part of AT&T and computer manufacturers coming up to us and saying, oh, we need more bandwidth. And we said, oh, this wire can carry up to 9,000 kilobits. You'll never need more than that. Today you have 110 baud. Who's ever going to use that? And we are pushing a megabit on the copper today. But the copper wire is really limited. That's the upper sort of, in spite of all kinds of modem technologies we have like DSL and all, the max you can put through is about a megabit or a few megabits. So we really want to go to a new infrastructure. That's one of the things optics will really provide us. And the reason it's important to think of optics not only from a consumer point of view, from one user, but today, if you took the total need of the world, let's assume we're going to provide 100 megabits to every user. And we're going to give each one of you a light for yourself. So you can have a blue one, blue two, pink one, pink two, whatever the light. Each bandwidth will give you a slice of light just for you. Doesn't matter where you go in the world, this light follows you. Okay. And by the way, we can in fact slice light that fine today into 100 megabit chunks. The total bandwidth need is only a 1 million terabit. Okay. Now, I say only 1 million terabit because the reason I'm saying that is today bandwidth, if you think of what a fiber can carry, it's about a terabit. Now, if you think of how you switch, network switch today, I come from an organization that built the world's largest network, phone network in the country, what used to be AT&T and Lucent one time. And this is sort of the diagram we had, except instead of fibers, we had these huge switches called 5ESS and 4ESS. If you think of what the AT&T did for this country, for 250 million people, we took all the phone wires, extracted them back into the single node in the network and sort of switched them. The phone wires carried 64 kilobit voice at that time. And imagine, we're supporting 250 million connections carrying 64 kilobit voice. And we did this all with centralized switches. Now, yes, it was not done with one switch. Actually, there were 113 number 4ESS, so-called long-distance switches. But they handled all the traffic. It was not a big deal. And bandwidth was not a problem. It was more the problem of getting a response time when you pick up the phone, whether you have a dial tone or not. But we could actually, our switches today support 1 million wires coming in and going out. So if I can support 1 million wires coming and going out at a 100 megabit, at a terabit, I can definitely build a switch that's even today's technology in terabit. Now, ideally what we would like the earth to be is that each person be connected with a light and have a huge glass bulb in the middle and switch all the lights around. The problem is that's still at least 10 years away. We're building light switches today, but they're not at 10 billion node size and switching 100 megabits a time. What we can do is you start building a hierarchy into the network. So you start building a hierarchy like you build 1 million node with terabits going out and then another one with a 10,000 node with 100 megabits going out. So you two-stage traffic. But logically, it all looks like a single glass bulb. So it looks like a centralized network to you. Now, the reason I'm demonstrating or showing you this is mostly to illustrate that today's technology will actually make that happen. That one, we have fibers through there that carry terabits, that carry 100 megabits. We actually have optical switches today, things like Lambda routers that Lucent announced, that have 1,000 node capacity. They'll switch 1,000 beams of light at about a terabit. So the question is, next stage would be 10,000. Like the Moore's law, in 3 months or in 6 months, you'll hear somebody announce that. But we will get to 1 million node in a few years. Very confident of that, that technology will accommodate this. So I believe that this will happen. For whether it happens for economic reasons or whether it happens for architectural reasons, the question is, given such an architecture, what would you do with this bandwidth? So the main question I'm coming to now is that we used to be all hard on what the bandwidth is going to do, but imagine if you were given the bandwidth today that you can, to every user that you want, send 100 megabits. How would you like your programs to be different? Or same, how would you like to do your programming and bill it and send it to each of the users? Would most of the users use the 100 megabit they're coming for playing internet games, for doing video mail, or would they be watching content? Or would they just replicate today's digital cable TV, for example? And those are very important questions for you to ask as content preparers and for us to prepare as network providers, because we really want to estimate what the consumers will do. Now, having seen the trend in the way data networking and voice has gone, what we believe users will really want is what we call the virtual fiber to the user model, is that we don't even like the high-speed LAN model. Most people are saying, oh, look at the way LANs have evolved, and we're going to just extend that LAN to the house. So you'll be part of a community LAN. Okay. And that over that community LAN, you'll get your data traffic, and you'll get, that's what DSL is doing today, or cable modems, and you'll get your video over that. And we don't want that. Actually, it turns out because we don't want shared things really with other users when it comes to private communication. It's okay for video watching. A cable goes by everybody's house, and everybody can take a dip at channel 2 to watch CBS or something like that. But when your voice communication goes by everybody's house and somebody can take a dip into that, you won't like that very much. Or if your internet traffic does that, I don't know how many of you have cable modems, but when your neighbor gets a cable modem, you really find out there's a shared network. It immediately drops to half or worse. You then go back to your 64 kilobit modems, you're better off that way. So what we really want is a personalized service. Okay, we want the virtual fiber 100 megabits, not as a shared bandwidth coming across. We really want it to come as guaranteed bandwidth. We want it to be managed so that it's private bandwidth to me. I want to guarantee that 100 megabits coming to me is 10 megabits for video, 100 megabits for 10 megabits for internet traffic, and 20 megabits for my voice traffic, and should not interfere. And it doesn't matter whether my neighbor gets similar traffic or not. I should get that traffic guaranteed. We really want this to be somewhat secure and reliable. And that's really, when you start paying for services like phone and all that, you really want that to happen. Now, we are working on architectures to support that. We believe in the architecture I was showing you earlier in terms of how you're deploying. We actually will be able to accomplish that. What's more important is that if you did accomplish that, how would you end up using it? So one of the ways we are trying to accomplish that is that we are trying to lay out, essentially we are trying to build the next generation cable head ends. If you think of today in the way networks are deployed, what a user has today from their house, from a telephone, is they go off to a main switch somewhere in the network. I'm pointing to this screen, I'm sorry, with my laser. I know I can't point laser both ways here. But in the network in the middle is where the data centers are. So you can think of this as a phone switch. You can think of it as your ISP, your data center for providing internet. You can also think of this as your cable head end. If you merge the three things, that's what the convergence is going to do. You'll end up having basically digital traffic going to each user over the fiber, but here the function of all three will be accumulated. So this will be your next generation voice switch for doing telephony, your next generation cable head end for doing satellite data traffic, you know, video content, as well as your ISP for providing internet service. Now it turns out that actually tomorrow's data centers can actually do that. And in some sense, today's cable companies and DSL companies are already trying that. They come into your house as cable for content, then they say we'll give you cable modem, give you ISP, data access, and then tomorrow they'll say we'll give you voice over that too. Same thing in DSL, they're trying to come in as fast internet service, but they'll put video on it and they'll put voice on it. And everybody's trying to be the unified sort of network. In some fashion or the other, you will get basically single access coming in and the data accumulation here. But if that happens here, basically what you're doing then is you're feeding data, you're feeding video, you're feeding radio, all kinds of media content. You sort of have a three-layer architecture. You have a private network to each user. Basically, in the end, the way the service will be, you'll have your own virtual network, your own virtual LAN coming to you from some service provider. You'll basically have the data centers of future, which are converged places where video, audio, and data will be converged, and you'll basically have a whole bunch of content providers who will be able to reach out here using satellites, using backbone fibers, using ATM, whatever else they like as technology. So this is where you'll start and really reaching out to the user in many fashions. Now, what's the problem of trying to converge this space? The reason this space hasn't been converged is this is where the mechanism for distribution becomes critical. For example, if you take a voice switch, put in here, a voice switch is used to connecting two parties only. I connect to you, your neighbor connects to so-and-so. It's a switch that's designed to connect many two-party connections. If you look at what a local cable does, it's a, what is called as a multicast, is a broadcast mechanism. It goes by all these users and carries the same data to everyone. So it's one-to-many, not one-to-one. And what we are doing now is we are building digital multicast distribution, what we call them as modified content distributors. I don't know whether to call them routers or call them distribution points or call them switches, but the next generation of router switches basically will allow you point-to-point as well as multi-point distribution within all switch traffic. That's sort of the next big breakthrough. If that happens, you basically can create on the fly a distribution network, a TV-like broadcast to 10,000 users, or a point-to-point 10,000 connections, whatever you like. The fact that you can actually do that is amazing because you can on-demand create a TV network, a channel, you know, so anybody can become a source. I can become a source and distribute to everybody else. Next time, your TV can become a source and distribute to everybody else. The thing is that if you can logically describe a distribution mechanism and ask for it, immediately anybody can become a broadcaster. So then the question is, how do you use that power in the network as you, as content providers, to allow really custom programming to each of the users? And I'm going to give you the example for that. This is sort of showing how the fiber is being deployed, but I want to get to, because we may run out of time, I want to give you a chance to ask questions. The real problem here is that if the network allows you to have a specification which says, I am a programmer, I'm creating a program for 10,000 kids, my 10,000 kids are distributed across these 12 cities, okay, if some network provider tells you, okay, give me that as a requirement, I'll lay out the network for you. And I'm going to communicate with them using MPEG-1 audio and video. And we'll create that for you. How would you essentially create that program, enroll these kids to come back and join that program and watch it? So what we really want to do is create for you the capability to do this sort of thing. Because when you think of what a user wants to be able to now select content from not just 1, 10, 100 channels, but thousands of channels. If you think of what's happening in the internet, what they did for data, is that the user went originally from going to one or two websites to billions of websites. In fact, I'm sure all of you, nobody knows how many websites are there, actually. You just go out on the web and search, right? It is, once it's gone PS one to many, it's now many, right? It's like the concept of windows on your screen. In the beginning, there used to be one, then there used to be four, and now it's virtually infinite, okay? Even though in practice you may use 10, 15, whatever, is the concept that you're virtually connected to any number of programs, any number of websites. It is the same problem here. As we become more video-enabled, each one of us, each node becomes a broadcaster. Just like today, webcast, you're watching Jenny Cam, somebody's dorm room, somebody's baby being born, somebody, all these are live sources of content for you. So tomorrow, there'll be a billion sources of video. Each one of us will be a broadcaster. The problem is just making every source available does not make for reasonable content. You still have to worry about how to package the content, and that's the skill that all of you have. It is not just source of generation. You know, news happens by itself. It happens because there was an accident, or a story happens by itself in many cases. You still have to be able to present it and create it in certain ways. We want that mechanism to be layered in some sense. We don't want user to just be selecting billions of channels. Like today, they cannot go through all the websites. There are search engines, there are mechanisms for them to create stuff and manage this information content in a reasonable way. We want, not only that, we want people to allow events of the two extremes, which is that we want a person to be able to join the world event. Everyone wants to watch Olympics. We all want to be able to join in. So we want the network to be able to scale, which says a user can join that. On the other hand, we want to go to the other extreme, where there are million events in which only two or three users are involved in each of these events. So we want to be able to create these groups of little TV stations where only two, three consumers are there. That's the equivalent of the chat rooms you have today on the web. So can we do that or not? And if you're able to do that, then we can actually do this, which is that we want to be able to specifically target ads and receive money before that. So because we'll have a mechanism to create a chat room just for us today, let's say for my talk, there can be an ad for Lucent behind me or GeoVideo behind me, like a little logo on the left or right something. And this will be just targeted to this particular market. Now, in order to create that, it basically creates what we call as a control nightmare. So I come from the world where we worry a lot about how do we program somebody's call versus somebody else's call. how do we do so-called feature generation, call programming, and what do you call a signaling networks? How do we signal this? In the broadcast network, most of the network is designed ahead of time. The network is planned out. You prepare your content in New York. It beams up from there to satellite, goes to 100 stations. 100 stations send it to their local affiliates, and it distributes out from that. And this architecture does not change for years and years, or every second, so forth. We're talking about some new system here where architecture per program is on demand. There is no prefixed architecture. You can source the content from Iowa now and Kansas City, wherever else, and that becomes the TV station, virtual TV station, and it can link to any number of users on the fly as you lay out your spec. So you still need, for you as a programmer, a mechanism to do that. We are defining mechanism what we call as the virtual theater. Now, I want you to think, this is the most important concept as far as I'm concerned, from a network designer point of view to somebody who will use the network. Now, the virtual theater is not just trying to create a 3D virtual theater for people to come in and do these avatars and acting stuff like that. That's not that what this term means. This term means we are giving to you a set of parameters for you to design. So let's assume that you're designing tomorrow's Sesame Street program. You as a program creator, not only do you design your content, but when you design your content, you have an idea who your audience is and what your audience is going to do with this program. So in fact, we're going to provide you a very, very rich set of tools. It's just like today, as a publisher, you're provided a very rich set of tools to write a document. Think of the word processor, Microsoft Word or Adobe Photoshop or whatever else you like as your favorite editors. It allows you to create a document in the richest form. It allows you to create pages, layouts, font selections, images, indents, whatever animation you want, how a user might present or read the information. Not just editing tools, but also its distribution. Okay. We wanted you to think of the virtual theater the same way. You should think of you and your audience that you're going with, your consumers, as part of this virtual theater. So tomorrow, if somebody came and said, let's design the Lincoln Center. Okay. So you already know what the constraints are. You want to be able to have music. You want to be able to have this kind of quality of sound, this quality of audio, this quality of reverberation, this kind of seating, the orchestra space, the rising floors, all that sort of stuff. This is sort of the mortar, brick and block in the same sense. You're building a virtual theater. From your point of view, saying my content is going to be of this kind. In Sesame Street, not only am I going to show the stuff, I would like kids to be able to vote, be able to talk to Big Bird. I want to be able to have little additional information which they're interaction on. Besides watching the video, they may be able to take calls back. They may be able to have websites that they're going to interact with. All of that is part of creation of the virtual theater here. So if I say that you can actually select who the users are, what sort of content they get, what sort of distribution you want, whether you want one to many, many to many, you want some grouping in there, each program you can now target to very specific users, decide an interaction model. We want to be able to build that. Now, the reason we believe we can do that is that that's sort of an extension of the learning we have already had in the internet space and in the voice space. If you go today to internet, when you go to AOL chat room, you're allowed to create your own chat rooms, your own buddy lists, your own sort of sessions that you like. And within that, you can now sort of exchange images, you can exchange sort of video. So in some bare sense, that sort of technology is coming through. From a control point of view, we already have software that allows you to create these virtual spaces, go back to the network, ask the routers to create the multicast trees for you. So essentially create the virtual broadcast network for this virtual theater. So today, if Ralph wants to create a virtual theater for his custom program and Lou wants to create a different virtual theater, there would be two separate theaters. And they may have separate audiences and may have separate network overlays. The nice thing is that you can actually specify using parameters like that. And when you decide to broadcast your program, it would online enroll such a network. It would ask the network for that and reserve the bandwidth and actually be a multicast and allow the session to happen. The nice thing to think is that in the extreme, this is really, for each program is its own TV station. We basically are allowing you to create your own virtual TV station of the style that you want, the kind of interaction you want. Now, I know that's a very big jump from where we are today, okay? But I really think you have to start thinking like that. My example of this is what happened to publishing industry and to the music industry to some extent. If you think of what happened to desktop publishing tools, it has allowed all of us to become publishers. You notice this PowerPoint charts were created by me. I remember 10 years back, I used to hand this off to somebody who would scribe, who would sit there, type, who would go produce this. And any kind of publishing was done by a group of people who knew how to do font editing, how to lay out lintype, make final documents, even if it was a newsletter or something. Today, all of us produce newsletters. My daughter does. Her class teacher sends these nicely published documents, says from the desk of Mrs. Rizzo. You know, it talks about, it's as if it's a magazine that's being pushed out in terms of what activities are happening in the class. Today, your tennis... Now, that does not mean all of us become John Grishams. You know, that's a different talent. He's a storyteller. We, you know, just because we can all publish documents does not mean we are successful in writing great novels or whatever else there. You know, there are still Steven Spielbergs needed, and there's still people like you needed. But the thing is, the mechanism has allowed us to each to become a publisher for our own domain. So I can write little documents, send my little email PowerPoints to 20 people that I want, and send that out as a document. Okay. You can write a little document. These tools and the distribution mechanism is powerful enough for all of us to become successful publishers in our own right. It is the same thing. In the TV industry and in the media industry, this is clearly going to happen. So what's needed to make this happen, really, I'm just giving you a perspective because I don't want to go into more technology detail and bore already the people who already are sort of ready to leave. The main intent here is to show you that this is the frontier that's coming. Not just, you hear a lot of talk about bandwidth all the time. It is not really the bandwidth. It is this programmability that really is going to change the world in terms of how you produce content. Just like making a digital camera available at home from everyone users. Today, everybody has digital cameras. Do you know what the biggest problem with that is? It's not that we are allowing people to shoot like hell. It's just that your home is now loaded with these tapes and these files you don't know what to do with. Nobody knows how to sort out. My kids come and say, oh, what about that birthday party? And I spent 2 days looking for this, you know, this little clip, you know. Now, where is the digital video really going to save you? It's going to save you because we're going to use the computer technology to create automatic file and distribution systems. Okay. You no longer will have to have these tons of video cassettes that you have marked briefly that you don't know what the whole hour tape really has. All the dances that your daughter went to and other stuff and search them, you'll be able to create automatic file systems for them. When you tape it, you just like you today have directories of your documents and files, and you'll be able to search in them automatically. You'll be able to say, okay, find me my daughter's dance when she was 3 years old. And boom, your computer will go to the digital files and search it. Makes it so much easier. So the idea of these new Sony Digitals or whatever other cameras you have that are capturing now on digital memory or mini DV or, you know, so-called iLink that allows you to transfer to computer is not so much the capture side. It is that it's linking you to a information management technology that already is very well defined and very well managed. Databases and indexing and sourcing, that is enormous help for all of us in terms of how content will be produced. Same thing with the network. We are becoming very efficient at distribution, at collecting and record and record keeping. That's where the actual... So the last model, which is that what we call is online provisioning. Provisioning is when you ask for a network and you go to the network provider and they say, oh, it'll take us 3 weeks to provision a T1 line for you. You must have heard that from AT&T and from us long time. That's just our job security, you know. We just want to make sure that. But it's going to change now, unfortunately, for us. We just have to allow online provisioning. So we want you to be able to sit there and say, give me a megabit going to this place, 3 megabits going there, and 100 megabits to these 10,000 users, and bang, you'll be able to get it. Okay. That's sort of the network requirement you'll be able to specify. And that's what I meant by online provisioning, and it's going to happen. Today, they're implemented as collection of servers in the network, including a directory server where the directory server is like your buddy list server, or what is called as IRQ, place where you go and find out if somebody else is there or not, whether your buddies are live and they're online. And if they're online, you can join the chat room. And then there is what is called as network audio or text sharing. I've said audio, but basically that's where this text gets shared. What the chat rooms are missing today is any content. The content is produced by the people themselves. So on the terminal side, they produce the content. The chat rooms allow sharing of that and goes back to the user. There is no feed from this side. And the biggest change that's going to happen is that the content people are going to start participating. So you can think of your television, TV room, or broadcast as a chat room. It's just one-way chat right now. Imagine tomorrow that it can be a two-way chat or n-way chat. Wouldn't that be, ooh, excuse me. It's truly multimedia conference here. You can see the force of this thing. We are building basically media hubs that will essentially allow for that content to be included into the infrastructure like chat rooms and all that. And the other thing we really want is, the only reason I put this up is of course, an ad for the GeoVideo browser too. But the main point to notice here is that we have always thought of video as one stream coming. So you know, I've been working on video for many years. The first time we were able to get video on a computer screen, we said, oh, we have integration. We can have one video window, lots of computer windows, and audio coming, and we can sit there. It's like having a TV with, just because it's a screen, you can watch TV within that. But, you know, just because you can put a washing machine and a dryer together, you don't sell them together all the time, right? That's not a reason to build them together. There has to be other reasons. So putting video in a computer screen, just because it can be done, doesn't mean people are going to do that. The reason you want to really do that is that there is something else the computer screen offers you, which is that it offers you this concept of window management, what we call as virtual windows. And you can think of each window as a virtual TV now. There's a link to just like you think of each window today as a link to a different website or a different program, you really want to think of video in that sense. A person at home should really think of having thousands of channels. My model of being communications, the ultimate communications, in terms of voice or in terms of video, is that I never should again have to establish a connection with people that I already know. It's the same way we mentally do. You know, you don't go back and reintroduce yourself to your wife. Hey, I'm Sid. Nice to meet you again. Let's continue from where, you know, you already have established. Relationship is a continued conversation. Those conversations are virtually interrupted but reconnected. So in some sense, with the people that we know well, the reason we know them well is those connections are continuous connections. You know, they break in physical sense in terms of media. It's like putting a call on hold and then recontinuing. But you never have to reestablish that. Next time when you hear me, you'll already know who Sid Ahuja is. He's this crazy guy talking about continuous connections or something like that. But I won't have to reintroduce the stuff that we already went through. You already know that, and we'll continue our conversation from there. In the same sense, we really think the model in the world is going to be of telephony or anything, is that you will establish a phone call to your daughter or to your son or whatever it is, and you'll always be connected. You'll just reappear in that call. So to me, I'll always own about 1,000 virtual calls that will be appearing on my cell phone. It's like the speed dial button. But today, the call is really not there. The network doesn't know about it today. You have to keep dialing 1702 some number. You have to keep dialing 170 some channel to get. So in the same sense, in the video, you'll always be connected to your favorite video channels. I always want to be monitoring what's happening in my school's in my kid's school in terms of TV monitoring. I always want to be watching the news channel CNN, and you'll just reappear in that window. Today in the computer world, you already do that. You leave many of your websites on all the time. They are continuously monitoring a weather channel, a stock channel, or whatever else you think of. Why not for video? Why not for audio communications? Why should I have to reestablish my number to you? The network should know it. And the network can know it. Doesn't matter I'm in Las Vegas or not in New York. It's connected to me because my cell phone's with me. It knows where I am. I'm virtually connected to my family. All they have to do is, it's like an intercom. They reappear in that line. So the physical resource can be assigned or deassigned. But it's the same concept with video channel. If you think of that, you can have the ultimate customer retention. They'll always belong to your virtual class at Sesame Street. They just have to reappear on the channel. They have subscription for life now for these programming. And you can now think of actually interacting with them in a very different way. I really believe that's very possible, and that's sort of the model we are really pushing. So that's my last chart. I want to actually give you a chance to ask me questions. What the bandwidth really enables you, and what this enables you in terms of concept, is not just the fact that you can get better and better quality video. A lot of the push for getting higher bandwidth, gigabits, terabits, was that we want to get from MPEG-1 to MPEG-2 quality to HDTV to whatever the better TVs. You know, once you've had, you know, you can see how fast HDTV is deployed. It's not just the quality that's driving. It is, in fact, the flexibility. If you look at what's driving the data needs today, it is not just the quality of connection you have for sake of getting better quality of data. It's that you want to get to bigger and bigger sites, more and more websites, more and more information that you want to collect. You want to be able to browse faster. It is the same thing. We really think the bandwidth will allow you to really virtually video connect to all the world and be permanently connected to some really rich sites. You want to be able to create those rich sites. So the challenge is for you is to say, how do I create a program that treats my customers not just as a one-point conversation, but now I can have a conversation with them. I got to get rid of this stuff. You guys haven't heard about wireless technology, right? But I really believe that given that as the model. No, you can't hear me now. Okay. Given that as the model, you should be able to have really a very rich sort of programming model. And that's the level you should start at. Please do not limit yourself by just thinking that we have today's cable TV or DSL or 1 megabit streaming coming down to you. This is the way the world is going to start deploying content out there. And I think it's very important for you to think of tools and network being available to you to do that. Thank you very much. So any questions there? Yeah. Go ahead.
Sid, I find your talk fascinating. Can you connect what you've just said to a subject that us broadcasters have been very concerned about over the years, and that's called universal service? The model that you're talking about certainly, from a practical standpoint, requires a fair amount of personal investment to get to that vision that you've talked about. But could you try to connect what you've been speaking of to the concern of universal access of different economic classes, both within our country and certainly throughout the world?
Very tough question. Most of you heard the question about universal access. We need presidents like Theodore Roosevelt and other people who initiated originally in the voice communications the requirement for universal service. I don't think just out of money or profit interest we would have ever done that either. Provide a 2-mile wire to a farmer in Peoria, Illinois to do the phone service just like we do to somebody in New York City. The economics are just not there. But let me tell you what drives actually more towards universal service today. One of the things that's driving everybody is just to reach out to a larger set of customers. And your customers today happen to be geographically distributed all over the place. They're not just in cities, they're in suburbs, they're in towns, they're in other countries and all that. And the thing that's really helped us is the wireless systems. If you notice, the way cell phones are deployed, as well as television, the way wireless, satellite-based television is done, is much more aggressively done in Asia as well as in other countries which did not have so much deployed infrastructure in the ground. Okay. Because the extant companies today have base here, we have fibers in the ground also, of course, we want to push that much harder. So we already provide you guys mechanism to distribute video over the ground. Hence, wireless hasn't come in as easily. But I know when I went to, for example, Malaysia, which has lots of islands, okay, they deployed satellite TV many, many years back. And therefore, TV was available to every farmer or every little village just because it was now universally broadcast. They did not have to put fiber down or cable down for everyone. If you look at wireless cell phones, I was just back in India and in Europe, everybody has cell phones. It's much more widely deployed than even here. And they're using it for chats, they're using it for discussions. So I think that trend has already allowed people to integrate and get knowledge that the users can be anywhere. When you have, and that's basically what I've said, that if you target the right set of users, they will drive the need for universal service much more than the infrastructure providers will. Before, we used to drive it because we used to figure out the economics. It's much easier to lay cable in the streets of Manhattan. Actually, it's not. You have to deal with all kinds of labor and other stuff. But it's much easier now to lay cable actually in Peoria than in Manhattan. So whatever the cost be, network companies are very conscious of where the economics are in terms of laying out first. But I think if you look at the content providers and the users, if your market is really 10,000 users and they're distributed and they want it, they are willing to pay for it, the network providers will come back and provide that service. And to some extent, that's happening with the internet service providers. The other thing is, you don't have to really wait for this sort of service to come by until you have all fiber and 100 megabit optics or something like that. You can deploy the concept of virtual programming, online provisioning, even when the bandwidth is not there, at lower qualities of programming and lower end participation. It depends on how you're willing to write your programs. See, in the internet market, that's happened. People, even if they have 14.4K modem, not everybody has got cable modem DSL, but people are participating in chat rooms and they're participating in virtual classrooms and whatever other mechanisms they have because the system is accommodating that. And the programs are accommodating that. The data that's being sent actually can tune down to that rate, which is what sort of you have to be conscious of. Other than that is more issue of politics and economics. And that's something is driven more as a social need than driven by people like technology, people like us. Thanks. I don't know if I've answered that adequately. Right. Go ahead.
Joe Cordova, KLVX. Back here in the back to the right.
Oh, there, I got it. Oh, that room. The lights are shining in my face, yeah. Go ahead.
MPEG-1 as an IP delivery, wasn't too bad. It's bandwidth efficient. And MPEG-2, we're pretty well doing now. Do you feel that MPEG-4 is really where it's going and that's where most of, your planning and future implementation, is that where you're heading?
we are doing a lot of work on MPEG-4 also. Not so much for high-end content, more for the wireless side. We are looking a lot more on, you know, MPEG-4 has this provisions for object-based coding and things like that, instead of trying to just worry about not recognizing what's the content in the data itself. We are doing mostly MPEG-4. It'll become a standard on the IP side, on the internet side, for the low bandwidth communication and for the what we call as error resilient communication, where you, if you take cell phones, you drop packets and things like that, you want to be able to recover. That's where most of the error recovery is being built. But on the high-end side, it won't matter that much. The way it matters actually is that any standard matters if it gets deployed widely enough. What's happening with MPEG-4 is, just like MP3 was used as a standard for audio, for distribution for free, there are a lot of MPEG-4 coders being sent out free. So what will happen is that a lot of content, at least small clips from, you know, classrooms, users, people that are not really in the high-end content, a lot of content will appear as MPEG-4 content. And so it will become a force to deal with, much more for the masses than for the high-end content provider. But I don't think in the ultimate it doesn't matter, actually. I mean, just like in the ultimate analysis, the rich audio content, people are still debating on and working on delivering content to the best quality they want to their customers. It's just that MP3 has shown us the way that on the web, you can actually distribute and create sites that easily allow distribution of audio content like that. And if you just left it to the broadcasters or to the six major recording companies, it would have never happened. So did I answer the question? MPEG-4 is important from that point of view. Yeah. Oh, we're out of time, okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.